when we were planning the conference, myself and Gord Heath were thinking through various different kind of Baptist scenarios, and obviously we thought through the wars that we wanted to talk about, and then we thought through, in addition to that, the kind of various types of Baptists, and I forget which one of us came up with the idea of doing something on the Cold War, and the normal possibility would be the American Baptists and the Cold War, and then it occurred to me, and for reasons I'll explain in a second, that it would be very interesting to look at the Soviet or the Russian Baptist experience in the Cold War. And the question is, who would be equipped, short of bringing somebody over from Russia, who would be able to address that? Well, our brother, Dr. Morris Dowling, has that ability. Dr. Dowling is a professor of church history, although he teaches outside of that. He teaches also in Christian doctrine and Old Testament at the Irish Baptist College, which is an affiliated college with the Queen's University in Belfast. And he has been there for the last 35 years or so. He is currently the chair of the Theology Education Committee that is part of that institution. There are a number of theological colleges, four, I believe, that are affiliated as part of theological colleges affiliated with Queen's University, Belfast. But Dr. Dowling also has a giftedness in Eastern European languages and knows a number of them. He is gifted in Russian and has for a considerable period of time been traveling back and forth to Russia, teaching at Moscow Baptist Seminary. And so when the idea came of the possibility of doing something on the Cold War, Morris's name came up as somebody who could handle the Russian sources and therefore be able to present to us what he's going to speak on today, Soviet Baptists and the Cold War.
Thank you very much, Michael. Thank you for the invitation to take part in the conference this year. There is a complete text of the paper, which I think everybody should have. So I'll just basically read through it and hope you can follow it all right. There is something odd about including in a conference on Baptists and war a paper which deals with what could be described as a non-war, albeit a conflict which was allegedly won by Ronald Reagan. The story of post-war relationships between the Soviet government and the Baptists begins shortly before the end of World War II. The 1930s were a period of savage persecution of believers. Official Soviet attitudes to religion changed during the war. One indication of this change was the restoration of the Moscow Patriarchate. Another was the formation, in October 1944, of the All-Union Council of Evangelical Christians and Baptists. This measure brought together two distinct movements, the Evangelical Christians and the Baptists. In 1946, the name was changed to All-Union Council of Evangelical Christians-Baptists, AUCECB. All-Union was the standard Russian adjective applied to any organization operating throughout the USSR, and the use of the term All-Union Council for this new body indicates a genesis in the minds of Soviet officialdom. In a post-communist publication, a Russian historian, Leonid Mitrohin, refers to the 1944 merger as a marriage Soviet style. Mention should also be made of the Law on Religious Associations of April 1929, which remained in force until October 1990. This law limited the rights of believers to the performance of services in registered buildings and made almost every other kind of religious activity illegal. Evangelism, religious education, literature work, raising money, indeed any activities not specified in the legislation. The 1929 law set in stone the all-important concept of registration, which would have a major impact on Baptist life in the post-war period. In any locality, A group of at least 20 adults who wanted to form a religious association were allowed to apply for permission to register as such. They also needed to have a registered building in which to hold meetings. If they failed either to register themselves as a group or to register their building, they could not legally function. Philip Walters has pointed out, it is worth noting that these local associations were the only religious administrative structures recognized by Soviet law until 1990. No central coordinating organs had any legal status. In other words, the All-Union Council of Evangelical Christians Baptists, although established by the Soviet authorities, did not actually have any status in law. The official Baptist journal, Bratski Vestnik, Fraternal Messenger, began publication early in 1945, not long after the formation of the AUCECB. For 3 years, 1950 to 52, it ceased publication. But soon after Stalin's death in March 1953, it reappeared without any explanation of what had happened. Obviously, it was not an undertaking which the Baptists could begin on their own initiative, and the non-committal not long after of the official history indicates that the publication of a journal was part of the government's plan for Baptist activities. It was no accident that the editorial board announced at the outset that the journal would contain, among other features, religious patriotic articles, Evangelical Christians and Baptists, and the Homeland. This type of article is actually mentioned at the top of a list, which includes topics of a biblical, historical, and biographical nature. And the patriotic note is sounded in one of the very first articles, The Christians, A Christian and the Homeland. Emphasizing that Christians cannot fail to love our native Soviet land, the article extols the many natural resources to be found within her, treasures of a kind that no other land knows. Is it not wonderful that thanks to Soviet power, all these treasures have become the property of the nation's masses rather than of a few rich people, which is what we see in other countries? How can we fail to love our homeland, which for centuries was a land in a state of slumber, but has been transformed into a land of work for all, a great anthill of nations, a land which has forgotten the meaning of unemployment? The article emphasizes that for a Christian, serving one's country entails military service. Christians who love their country should defend her by bearing arms. In the second issue, the journal celebrates Victory Day. This is the day, a happy and joyful day of victory and peace the Lord has made. The editor stressed the part played by Christians in the defeat of the enemy and exhorts readers, as we were in days of war, so let us be in days of peace, exemplary citizens of our land. Let us be light and salt for all. In the spirit of patriotism, one writer asserts that believers have complete freedom not only for worship services, but for conducting necessary activity relating to all aspects of our religious life. I point out in the footnote, if my translation sounds clumsy, you should see the original. In the spirit of patriotism, the article then goes on to say, beyond the borders of the USSR, there are people who relate all kinds of fables about religious life in the USSR. But such people are either malicious slanderers or they just don't know what they are talking about. May God judge all these troublemakers. We, however, will use every opportunity presented to us and will firmly commit ourselves to carrying on our ministry in the name of our dear Savior and Lord Jesus Christ, giving thanks for everything to our God and Father and our Soviet government, which has given us these glorious and legal opportunities. The writer is very dismissive of the many and various foreign missions which have taken it upon themselves to gather funds for the work in Russia. Such help would only foster conflict and division. And in any case, it is unnecessary because AUC, ECB believers are perfectly capable of providing from their own resources everything necessary for the Lord's work in their land. Another interesting example of the journal's patriotism is a two-page article on the greatness of the Russian language, a language which for its amazing sonority and flexibility knows no equal. It is difficult to imagine an article extolling the glories of English appearing in an English language Christian publication, and such an article might well provoke the question, which English? The background is clearly the post-war Soviet drive for greater purity in the use of Russian, and particularly the avoidance of servility towards the West where language is concerned. The Bratsky Vestnik article was not as xenophobic as some Soviet publications on the subject, but it does express concern for the preservation of the purity of Russian, not ruining the language, not using foreign words incorrectly or unnecessarily. As indicated in various reports and letters in Bratsky Vestnik, the AUC-ECB was accepted into the worldwide Baptist family, and Soviet Baptists resumed contact with Christians abroad, the kind of contact which was impossible during the 1930s. In a splendid understatement, the official history of the evangelical Christians Baptists in the USSR says that, for reasons which did not depend upon our brethren, Soviet Baptists could not be represented at BWA congresses in Berlin, Atlanta, Copenhagen, and Cleveland. They were due to be present in Copenhagen, but the conference agenda was felt to be too sensitive politically. And in the USSR by 1950, the Stalinist pressure and the effects of the Cold War were such that the question of their attendance at Cleveland simply did not arise. However, international contacts became an important part of AUC-ECB life. The Red Dean of Canterbury, Hewlett Johnson, visited the Moscow Central Baptist Church in 1945. According to the official AUC-ECB history, in June 1946, a Soviet Baptist delegation attended a conference of the Swedish Baptist Union. However, according to the report in Bratsky Vestnik, by the time they reached Stockholm, the conference was over, and they were possibly not helped by the fact that it took them 5 days to get from Moscow to Stockholm. Nevertheless, they were able to have some fellowship with Swedish Baptists and then travel on to a Finnish Baptist conference. There, according to the same report, a Finnish Baptist leader said that Baptists in Finland very much regretted the misunderstanding which had occurred between Finland and her great neighbour, the Soviet Union, and expressed the hope that this would never again happen in the future, and that Baptists in Finland would work with the aim that the two countries would in future live as good neighbours in a peaceful relationship with one another. Not having the original remarks made by the Finnish Baptist, it is impossible to know how much editing or toning down took place in the Russian version. Even allowing that the conflict was dwarfed by the scale of Soviet war casualties in 1941-45, misunderstanding is an odd way to refer to the Winter War of 1939-40, which left some 25,000 Finnish dead and many times that number of Soviet fatalities. There was even some contact with American Baptists. In 1946, Louis Newton, soon to serve as president of the Southern Baptist Convention, visited the USSR and was given an encouraging account of Baptist life there. Bratsky Vestnik published a detailed report of his visit, during which he apparently reassured Soviet Baptists that their American brethren enjoyed freedom to serve God too. According to the report, Alexander Karev, who was General Secretary of the Soviet Baptist Union, said that Newton's visit had contributed to the development of relationships between Soviet and American Baptists, and he asked Newton to convey to our brothers and sisters in the USA that Russian Baptists, together with the whole nation, are involved in the great task of the reconstruction of their land. An interesting glimpse of what it was like for foreigners to visit the USSR in the Stalin era was given by a group of English Quakers, four men and three women, who were there for nearly 2 weeks in July 1951. Among the religious leaders they met was AUC-ECB president Yakov Zhitkov, a sincere little man with a neatly trimmed goatee beard, who told them that there were over 200 million people in Russia, not one of whom was for war. But some Baptists, Congregationalists, and Methodists abroad wanted war. Truman and Bevin, he said, were Baptists. I hope our dear guests will help to draw all sections of the Christian community into the fight for peace. If you can get the Baptist Truman into that path, we will be grateful. At a subsequent meeting, Zhitkov read to us the various peace messages which from time to time they had sent to their brother Baptists in England and elsewhere, including an appeal to the Baptists all over the world to express their categorical protest against the aggression of the United States in Korea. They complained wistfully, though without bitterness, that they had received little or no response from British and American Baptists. The Quakers' visit occurred during the three-year period, 1950 to 52, when no issues of Blatsky Vyestnik were published. However, a report of the visit appeared when the journal resumed publication in 1953. The report relates specifically to contacts the Quakers had with Russian Baptists and consists mainly of comments made by the Quakers themselves in the publication already quoted. It makes a point of mentioning the Russian Baptist appeal to Baptists everywhere to express a categorical protest against U.S. aggression in Korea. The very first article in the revived journal was a lengthy one on the involvement of the evangelical Christians Baptists of the USSR in the cause of defending peace. The article describes how in 1950, armed forces of the United States of America began their campaign of devastation against North Korea. American planes dropped bombs not only on military objectives, but also on non-military, on fields where peasants were peacefully working, on hamlets where innocent children were playing, on factories producing food. In a word, they subjected Korea to total bombardment. The article describes how world opinion was horrified by this inhuman destruction of the peaceful population of Korea, and how letters from all over the world were sent to the UN Security Council condemning this evil in Korea. The Council of the Union of Evangelical Christians Baptists in the USSR also sent a protest to the Security Council. In their protest, the Evangelical Christians Baptists of the USSR declared, "Thousands of American bombs are falling on towns and settlements, where there are defenseless old people, women and children. We, the Evangelical Christians Baptists of the USSR, express our deep outrage and condemnation of this inhuman destruction of the peaceful population of Korea. And we unanimously concur with the most noble and most humanitarian demand of the Soviet government that military action in Korea should cease immediately." By the time the Baptist Journal resumed publication in 1953, the Korean War was almost over. Nevertheless, the editors probably had no choice but to regurgitate the type of Cold War rhetoric seen in the Soviet press during the conflict. An indication of the immediate post-Stalin change in government policy, the Khrushchev thaw, is the visit in June-July of 1954 of BWA representatives to a number of Soviet cities, where they were enthusiastically welcomed by local Baptists. At a farewell breakfast in Leningrad on July the 1st, Baptist leaders Yakov Zhitkov and Alexander Karyev expressed their deep satisfaction that their guests had been able to spend time in the USSR and personally assure themselves of the complete religious freedom which believers enjoy in the USSR, and that they now have the opportunity to tell people in the West the truth about believers in the USSR and about the whole Soviet nation, full of enthusiasm for what they are building and for the struggle in the glorious cause of peace. The guests were Fred Townley Lord, president of BWA, Walter Lewis, BWA Associate Secretary for Europe, and Ernest Payne, General Secretary of the Baptist Union of Great Britain and Ireland. On their return to London, they reported, "Our Russian brethren assured us that there is now complete freedom of worship in the Soviet territories, and that all religious communities enjoy equal rights and opportunities. Many young people are applying for baptism and church membership. Before acceptance, they have to undergo a prolonged period of testing and probation, their names being made known publicly to the local church. The names of these young people would no doubt also become known to the authorities." In a further report, Townley Law wrote, "We are often asked, is there religious liberty in Russia? I do not think the term religious liberty in the Soviet Union is interpreted in the broad way to which we are accustomed in the West. But from our observation, we were left in no doubt that Russia allows a freedom of worship in buildings designated for that purpose. The establishing of new churches and the designating of buildings for worship was, of course, totally at the discretion of the communist authorities." At the BWA Jubilee Congress in London, 1955, 9 delegates represented the USSR. In his address, the AUCCB president, Yakov Zhitkov, who became one of the BWA vice presidents, understandably made no mention of the reason why Soviet Baptists had not been present at a BWA Congress since 1928. Furthermore, he reassured his hearers, "All our members, all our churches, enjoy full freedom for preaching the gospel and bringing up and educating new members. This liberty, this freedom, is guaranteed by the main laws of our country, and in conducting services, we do not encounter any obstacles." Zhitkov's address also reflected the official Soviet policy of being in the vanguard of the World Peace Council. Besides the evangelical work which we carry on, the Baptists of the Soviet Union also participate in the cause of the defense of world peace. All evangelical Christian Baptists in the Soviet Union are advised by Christ's words, "Blessed are the peacemakers." And we understand these words not only as peace in the family or peace between individuals, but we understand it as peace between countries and nations and peace for the whole of humanity. We hope that at this Congress, we shall hear the voice of the Baptist World Alliance speaking against Cold War, armaments drive, the preparation of a new war, and the production and use of nuclear weapons. Of course, what Zhitkov could not say was that in his own country, anyone, Baptist or otherwise, who dared to criticize Soviet arms spending and production would quickly be suppressed. Also in 1955, just after the London Congress, a delegation which included Theodore Adams, BWA President, Arnold Ohren, General Secretary, and two other prominent American Baptists, Joseph Jackson and V. Kearney Hargroves, undertook a 2-week tour of Baptist churches in Russia, covering over 3,000 miles and being warmly received wherever they went. The Soviet government, anxious to present itself as tolerant of religion and committed to the cause of world peace, saw the propaganda value of fostering these kinds of contacts. And Soviet Baptists were both genuinely patriotic and also anxious to have as many lines of communication open as possible to their government and to their brethren in the West. They also had to keep making the right kinds of noises. Zhitkov's lengthy report on the Western visit ends with the comment, "We are sure that the time spent by our dear brethren, our guests from the USA in the USSR, has given them the opportunity to see how our beloved homeland lives a vibrant life, how our evangelical Christian Baptist communities live a free and full spiritual life, and how strong is the universal aspiration of our whole nation and of all the believers for peace with all nations, including the people of the USA." Zhitkov, now aged 75, returned to the theme of peace in his address to the 10th BWA Congress in Rio de Janeiro in 1960, where he again highlighted the role of his own government. "We are glad to note the words of the Archbishop of Canterbury, Dr. Fisher, said by him in connection with the proposal of the Soviet government for universal and complete disarmament. No Christian could have put forward a better program than this. This proposal is a Christian solution of the problem of disarmament." Artur Mickiewicz, later Assistant General Secretary of the AUCECB, who was elected to the BWA Executive Committee, had on the previous day given a brief report to the Rio Congress on Baptist work in the USSR. He too stressed the Soviet Baptists' commitment to the cause of peace and disarmament. Neither he nor Zhitkov could say anything about Khrushchev's anti-religious campaign, which was well underway by then. A modern Russian Baptist historian, Sergei Savinsky, comments in a study published in 2001, "In their meetings with foreign brethren, AUCECB staff always emphasized the necessity of the struggle for peace on earth. This became a kind of incantation which could not be omitted." Almost at the very end of his book, Savinsky concludes, "When discussing the international contacts between the AUCECB and fellowships in other countries, we cannot but indicate the sad aspects which relate to the question of religious freedom in the USSR. In their meetings with representatives of foreign fellowships, the AUCECB leadership, when asked whether in the USSR there were any cases of harassment of believers for religious reasons, always answered in the negative, asserting that in the USSR, people were not persecuted or put on trial for their faith. And this was when, throughout all the post-war years, with the exception of 1953-1956, the years of the Khrushchev thaw, persecution and trials of believers did not cease, and in the 1960s actually increased. Such statements by the brethren can be explained, but they cannot be justified. We recall this not in a spirit of condemnation, for God is the judge, but with deep sorrow." Khrushchev's policies. There was a significant increase in religious persecution in the years 1959-64. This is often overlooked when Nikita Khrushchev's time is portrayed as one of East-West détente and of an emphasis on peaceful coexistence. The anti-religious campaign was very much the initiative of the Soviet premier himself, and it marks something of a change from the tense but generally less confrontational tone of church-state relations in the immediate post-Stalin era. Khrushchev, who was, in Tony Judd's memorable phrase, reliably unpredictable, was fired by an almost apocalyptic vision of the collapse of capitalism, the building of socialism and eventually communism. And he and his minions stridently made the point that religion would have no place in this brave new world. He did not, however, need to enact fresh legislation. The 1929 law simply needed to be applied with all possible rigor, and any uncertainties in the law could easily be interpreted to the disfavor of believers. Anti-religious propaganda, it was felt, had to be multiplied and improved, and all possible measures taken to eradicate religious life in the USSR. Savinsky claims that Khrushchev at first made fairly concessionary noises in the direction of believers, while all the time planning a campaign of intensified aggression against the churches, the beginnings of which can be seen in 1957 with the emergence of a more sophisticated scientific atheism. Such was the intensity of the campaign that, Savinsky says, by the end of 1959, the AUC-ECB was on the verge of dissolution. Although there is ample evidence of damage done to the Orthodox Church, Tatyana Nikolskaya, another post-Soviet Russian Protestant scholar, has argued that the main targets of repression were those who had long been labeled sektanti, not only by Soviet society, but also by the Orthodox Church. Sektanti, roughly translated as sectarians, is a pejorative umbrella term for non-Orthodox believers, such as the Baptists or Pentecostals and Jehovah's Witnesses. And the word is still widely used today. Baptists and others are not seen as members of true Christian churches, but as sect members. Nikolskaya writes, the distinctiveness of the Khrushchev anti-religion campaign was that although it was in effect directed against all religions and confessions, the ideology of that time bore a clearly expressed anti-sect character. In contrast to the 1930s, when the terms churchmen and sectarians had an equally pejorative hue, the latter now acquired a particularly negative significance. The Russian Protestants were numbered among the sectarians. A significant proportion of the anti-religious publications of the central and local mass media were directed against them. As with all persecutions, much depended on local factors and officials, and precise information on variations in severity is not available. But generally speaking, it is very likely that the love-hate relationship with Christianity, which Soviet people enjoyed, resulted in a greater degree of hate being directed against sektanti than against the Orthodox. The Orthodox Church was, after all, an integral part of the history of Russia, and the Soviet war effort had made conspicuous use of a type of Holy Russia discourse associated with such heroes as Alexander Nevsky, Ivan the Great and Ivan the Terrible, General Kutuzov, and even those who fought in the Russo-Japanese War of living memory. In so many proud moments, the Orthodox Church had played a major part, but the sektanti were of foreign stock and really had no place in the Russian grand narrative. Whatever views were held about them by Soviet authorities and society, the Baptist leadership, through the pages of Bratsky Vestnik, continued to assure everyone of evangelical Christian Baptist loyalty to the state and its international policies. A two-page article of 1961, entitled Christianity and the Cold War, reflects the official line that blame for international tension lies, of course, with the West. The article comments on the problem of the relationships between East and West and laments the division of the world into two hostile camps. What makes matters worse is that Christians are being drawn into this conflict, as can be seen, supposedly, from a reading of the Christian press. Whenever you pick up today's ecclesiastical press, you can't avoid the significant number of articles which are designed to draw Christians into the Cold War between East and West and to instill into them the medieval idea of the Crusades. One asks, where were these articles being published? The writer of the Blatsvestnik piece does not name names, but obviously no ecclesiastical press existing in the USSR would ever publish material of this kind. The implication is that the Western religious press was being used to encourage a warmongering spirit among Western Christians. Where else would the Crusader mentality take root but in the West? Soviet churches, like the Soviet people in general, were of course not to blame for Cold War tension. The peace and freedom issues. 25 years after the Evangelical Christian Baptist official publication began life with an article on the Christian and the homeland, another longer article with the same name was written by Alexander Karev, published in 1970. This article, too, emphasizes the Christian duty to love one's homeland and the special privilege of being a citizen of the USSR with all her proud achievements. Two virtues in particular are highlighted in rapid succession. In days when, like the sword of Damocles, the threat of another Cold War, another World War, this time an atomic war, hangs over the human race, our homeland constantly calls all nations of the earth to peace, friendship, and mutual cooperation. We are especially glad that by God's grace there are thousands of places in our land where the gospel is being preached and the good news of our Lord Jesus Christ is being proclaimed. On their visits abroad, in their meetings with visitors to the USSR, in their publications, Soviet Baptists made a point of drawing people's attention to these pluses of the Soviet system. The themes of peace, peaceful coexistence, disarmament, and the dangers of nuclear war often featured in Bratskivestnik articles. A regular section called The Voice of Christians in the Defense of Peace could contain a number of items relating to the international peace movement, particularly Soviet contribution to it. From 1966 onwards, we read occasional criticisms of U.S. policy in Vietnam, usually found in reports of international peace conferences or declarations by, for example, the WCC. A report of an interview with Martin Luther King just before his death has King saying that this unjust war is consuming the soul of our nation. A few months later, the Journal published an obituary for King, which mentions in particular his opposition to the Vietnam War and his struggle for justice in his own land. The article which contains the obituary also has a rather strange report of a service held in the Moscow Central Baptist Church to celebrate King's life. The service was attended by, quote, a group of Negro believers from the USA. However, quote, the leader of the Negro group passes on greetings on behalf of churches in East Africa and Madagascar and speaks of the sufferings which, quote, we in Africa endure. Furthermore, the date of this service is given as April the 7th. King was assassinated in Memphis in the early evening of April the 4th, which by Moscow time means the early hours of April the 5th. And so the speed of preparation for the service must have been breathtaking. Vietnam was the subject of a lengthy article in 1969, Christians Against the Vietnam War, which reported an address given by Alexander Karev at an interfaith conference in Zagorsk. It waxes eloquent on the horrors perpetrated by U.S. forces and calls upon Christians to follow the example of the Good Samaritan by giving support to the Vietnamese people. The end of the war was noted in a brief article saying how glad the evangelical Christians Baptists were when they heard the joyful news. The ending of the war in Indochina was the result of the self-sacrificing struggle of the Vietnamese people, the efforts of people of goodwill, and the fervent prayers of Christians all over the world. At a Sunday service in the Moscow Baptist Church, a special prayer of thanksgiving was offered and a collection was made in aid of the people of Vietnam, ruined by a long and cruel war. Although it was not seen as a formal ending to the Cold War, the meeting between President Jimmy Carter and Soviet Premier Leonid Brezhnev in Vienna in June 1979, and the signing of the SALT II agreement, seemed to herald an era of better relations between the USSR and the West. Bratsky Vyestnik published congratulatory telegrams from the AUCECB leadership to Brezhnev and to Carter. The message to the U.S. president acknowledges that the prayers of your fellow believers, the Baptists of our land, have been answered. Citing the biblical injunction, choose life, the Russian Baptists say, we are sincerely grateful to the Lord and to you for this choice of ways that lead to peace and prosperity. A new chapter in the Cold War was, of course, just about to start with the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in December 1979. In May 1982, Billy Graham made his long-awaited journey into the USSR. Bratsky Vyestnik published a report of his meeting with Russian Baptist leaders, which contained the comment, from our conversation with him, we learned that in the course of his life, he had had three points of spiritual rebirth. The first was when the Lord Jesus Christ met with him and named him as his child. The second was when he realized the horrors and the injustice of segregation. And the third was when he understood that Christians have to do everything in their power to prevent a nuclear catastrophe from occurring on Earth. Graham was in Moscow to attend a conference which had the rather cumbersome title, Religious Activists Working to Save the Sacred Gift of Life from a Nuclear Catastrophe. The conference, attended also by Duke McCall and Denton Lotz, was covered in some detail in the journal, with 8 pages devoted to Graham's address on Christian faith and peace in the nuclear age. Graham was also reported to have commented in conversation that he had come to the Soviet Union at a time of great tension between our countries. The reports are all rather bland and repetitive, stating the obvious, that nuclear war would be a bad thing. There was never a hint that Soviet policy in Afghanistan might have contributed to international tension. Baptists at War, which somebody back home thought was the title of this conference. Appropriate, perhaps. Even if one were to devote a whole paper to the conflict between the official Baptists, the AUCECB, and the so-called Council of Churches, it would be impossible to do justice to all the complexities of this chapter in Soviet and post-Soviet Baptist history. The problems began in 1959-60 and are related to the anti-religious drive of Khrushchev's time. The authorities pressurized the Baptists into complying with the 1929 laws, which it was felt were not being observed as strictly as they should be. The AUCECB issued documents imposing severe restrictions on church life, particularly in evangelism and work among children and young people. Opposition to the AUCECB leadership appeared almost at once and was expressed by an action group, literally an initiative group, hence the label Initiativniki, of 12 people headed by Alexei Prokofiev and Gennady Kruchkov. The initiative group was replaced by an organizing committee, Orgkomitet, in which Georgi Vince played a major role. In 1965, the organizing committee changed its name to the Council of Churches of the Evangelical Christians Baptists. Although this was not their original tension, they soon evolved into a rival Baptist union. From the outset, many of the unregistered Baptists, as they became known, suffered imprisonment. And in 1964, the Council of Prisoners' Relatives was formed to gather data on Baptist prisoners and, as far as possible, disseminate it in the West. Over the next 20 years, until the dawn of Glasnost and Perestroika, much Western concern for the underground church in the USSR was focused on the Council of Churches and on the Council of Prisoners' Relatives. The AUCECB argued that any members of unregistered churches who were in prison were there because they had violated the law of the land. Representatives of the Council of Churches argued that the law was such that no genuine Christian could comply with it. Western Baptists often found themselves in a difficult position and were sometimes criticized for being duped by the AUCECB leadership. It was difficult for them to know how to respond to the stream of information about religious persecution, which was being smuggled out by groups such as the Council of Prisoners' Relatives. If they took up the cause of Baptist prisoners in the USSR, they risked alienating the AUCECB, who had to repeat the official line that nobody in the Soviet Union would be in prison for purely religious reasons. The Soviet government encouraged official Baptist contacts with brethren abroad as a way of counteracting the information transmitted to the West by the underground church, the emergence of which presented the government with a new set of headaches. Tatiana Nikolskaya writes, "Whereas previously they, the authorities, had thought of religious extremes in terms of sectarian exclusivity, rejection of the cinema, theatre, television, etc., now the authorities had to contend with believers on a large scale listening to foreign radio broadcasts, having illegal contact with fellow believers abroad, receiving literature and material help from abroad, sending abroad information about religious persecutions, submitting applications to leave the USSR, rejecting Soviet citizenship." From the late 70s, the authorities started to allow significant numbers of Baptists to leave, which further contributed to the flow of information. Those who worked on behalf of the underground church were seen as agents of Western imperialism. On the other hand, the Soviets were to a certain extent sensitive to Western public opinion. So if a Christian prisoner's case or an instance of harassment of a local congregation was known abroad, this was often a restraining factor. Controlled emigration was felt to be preferable to an unworkable attempt at total suppression. Nikolskaya argues that Soviet Baptists were generally at a distinct advantage compared with, say, dissident Pentecostals, because of the strength and influence of the Baptist community abroad. And she sees a connection between the start of Baptist emigration from the USSR and the Baptist Jimmy Carter's time as US president. Still today, probably the best known of the Initiativniki is Georgi Vince, who was eventually exiled from the USSR in 1979. He was the subject of a Cold War transaction, being sent to the USA in exchange for captured Soviet spies. In the West, he campaigned energetically on behalf of the underground church and sought to advise Western Christians against accepting what was said by the AUC-EBC leadership. A summary of an interview for Christianity Today has Vince saying, "Did you ever notice that when AUC-ECB Secretary Alexei Bychkov or other leaders of the All-Union Council come to the West, they never encourage people to pray for those who are suffering. They don't ask people to pray for the children in Russia or for the work of the gospel. They always say everything is fine. The government is giving us an opportunity to serve the Lord, they say. But where are the children and the young people?" In the same issue, Christianity Today, Denton Lotz offered a different perspective on the churches in the USSR, calling for greater understanding of the situation which confronted AUC-EBC leaders, and emphasizing that in spite of the restrictions, there was a tremendous movement of God's Spirit. In particular, the fact is that the youth are flooding the churches. Thus, the complexities of Baptist life in the USSR generated a classic case of conflicting signals. Some concluding comments. One post-Soviet commentator has written, "The Russian Protestant movement possesses a host of contradictions and conflicts, many of which can be traced back to the structural and ideological rendering of forces during reordering of forces during the Soviet era. The conflicts and contradictions are seen not least in the fine line which the official Baptist leadership in the USSR had to tread in their relationships with the Soviet government and officialdom, and also in their contacts with foreigners. For several decades, Soviet Baptists lived in a closed society under a regime which was to varying degrees hostile towards religion, and in the post-war era, the regime was engaged in bouts of tension with the West. On the one hand, they were as entitled to their patriotism as Baptists in any other land or time. On the other hand, they were in a situation where open criticism of official policy and ideology invited heavy penalties, something to which patriotic Baptists in Britain or the USA were not exposed. On the one hand, their extensive championing of peace causes was understandable in a land which suffered the loss of 27 million people killed in World War II, and in a world which was threatened by the real possibility of a nuclear holocaust. On the other hand, they had to remain silent about their own government's responsibility for international tension and the arms race, about the fate of conscientious objectors, about Soviet dissidents, Christian or otherwise, about Soviet occupation of the Baltic states, Soviet domination of Eastern Europe, Soviet intervention in Hungary, Czechoslovakia, and Afghanistan, or about Stalin's failure to foresee the danger represented by Nazi Germany. Reflecting on the significance of the collapse of the Soviet Empire, Tony Judd says, "After 1989, nothing, not the future, not the present, and above all, not the past, would ever be the same. Re-examining the past has become a major industry in the former Soviet lands, and new history is one of the many phrases generated by the collapse of communism. The tensions and contradictions which the Soviet era generated have not altogether gone. Russian Baptists have to live with them, just as we all have to live with the minus side of our past, whether individual or corporate. In the Cold War era, the Soviet Baptists demonstrated what Tatiana Nikolskaya sees as the survival capability that has marked Russian Protestantism throughout its history." Writing in 2000, Sergei Filatov said that Protestantism in Russia is not just growing, it is also becoming more and more Russian. This process of growth will entail not only making the most of opportunities for the future, but taking an honest look at the past. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. Time for questions.
So, if you could shout more or less, as I'm a bit hard of hearing too.
Could you speak to in terms of the registered Baptist involvement, their subjection to the state?
Mm-hmm.
My understanding is it's not entirely total, but there was actually a subversive element inside the registered churches as well. Can you speak to that at all historically?
A subversive element inside the registered churches?
As an example, part of it's just is personal knowledge. The people who taught me Russian met at a youth activity in the late 60s that was sponsored by two registered churches. But it was a youth camp that was kind of subversive thing.
The history of the relationships between the registered Baptists, the AUC-ECB, and what became the Council of Churches, the underground churches, a very complex relationship. And relationships on the ground were often a good deal more fraternal, and there was a good deal more cooperation than sometimes the official statements made by the Baptist leaders would suggest. And I'm thinking particularly of statements made by people like Georgi Vince and Gennady Khrushchev, both of whom I met, and their statements about the godless union, as they called it. And I remember in one of my first visits to the former Soviet Union, being in the home of a representative of the unregistered Baptists with two other men in Kiev, this was. And his first question to us was, when you're here, are you going to meet with any representatives of the registered Baptists? The implication was, if you are, then I don't want to talk to you. So on the ground, and I think this is the point of your question, relationships could be a good deal more cordial. And, for example, if particularly from the underground church a man was imprisoned, the family had no visible means of support, members of the registered Baptist church could come to their aid. There's a lot of anecdotal material there, a lot of material in letters and diaries and so on, but certainly on the ground relationships were often a good deal better than the official pronouncements would suggest. So does that answer your...
When I was growing up, I heard two stories. One was the evil, the unregistered are the good ones, registered ones are the bad ones. But when I actually went to Russia, what was striking to me was how the registered churches would speak to me in terms of what they were doing under the covers.
Right. When was this? May I ask when this was?
This would have been right after Perestroika.
Times had changed. I mean, you're talking about the late 1980s.
Yes.
Times had certainly changed. And I think there were members of the registered Baptist churches who were glad when Perestroika came, and they were able to do something. They were able to do things for which they would have got into trouble even for asking permission. So it's that period up to the mid-80s, which is often the very difficult period in sort of how the official leadership, especially in contacts with people abroad, they have to make the right kinds of noises. I mean, you see this even in the... I quoted from the journal, the Bratsky Vesny, the official Baptist journal. I mean, they have to be so careful. Even in sort of devotional, biblical articles, say, writing an article on the prodigal son or conversion, you have to be careful not to suggest that there is anything wrong with Soviet man or woman, that their lifestyle is wrong, that they're dissatisfied with their lot in life. Extremely careful. It's very often what is not said, as well as what is actually said, that gives you the clue. They're bending over backwards not to suggest that anything is wrong with Soviet society.
To kind of dovetail your last few sentences there, were there any major, did that result in major theological differences between the registered and unregistered churches?
I wouldn't say theological differences. I mean, they're both held to, you could say, a fairly fundamentalist view of Scripture. I mean, the biblicism was very strong. The difference was in interpretation of what other texts in you know, Romans 13, you know, be subject to the higher power, or we must obey God rather than man. You could say, perhaps simplistically, that it was a clash between different perspectives related to those verses, be subject to the powers that be. On the other hand, we must obey God rather than man. And certainly the official leadership would say that on the one hand, they were subject to the powers that be, they complied with the law on registration, etc. But they say, well, we found other ways of getting around the law and doing things that we weren't supposed to do according to the 1929 law, which is very much of a piece with Russian/Soviet attitudes to law anyway. This saying that somebody told me, that the law is like a puddle. If it's a large puddle, you walk round it. If it's a small puddle, you step over it. Now, of course, this can work both ways, that the rule of law doesn't have that significance, that even if the law is technically on your side, and Russian evangelicals are finding this today, even if the law is on your side, it doesn't help you because the official actually implementing the law is not on your side. But it could also work in your favor that the law is there, but nobody's really implementing it all that carefully. And an awful lot depends upon these very difficult to measure local factors. And this is all go back to the early church. I mean, in the Roman Empire, Christians might have been clobbered in one town, but in the next town, there was no problem at all. And this happened in the Soviet Union, that you might get one Christian group severely harassed, in the next town, the Christian group is left alone. Sorry, I think this gentleman here.
I had two questions. First was, the underground church, was it mainly Baptist? Were there aspects that were not Baptist?
The underground church, Baptists, Pentecostals, Mennonites, it's a sort of umbrella term for dissident groups. What happened in 1944 was the creation by the authorities, in other words, by Stalin, of this all-union council of evangelical Christians, Baptists, bringing together the two traditions which had existed long before the revolution, the evangelical Christians and the Baptists. But it also became a body in which other groups were to be incorporated, the Pentecostals, the Mennonites, sort of independent groups of no particular label. It was a sort of catch-all Protestant denomination. And what happened gradually was that various non-Baptist groups, in effect, cut their links with the official AUC-ECB body. And this was happening actually before the split between the registered and the unregistered Baptists. So that the underground church consisted of Baptists who rejected the law on registration and other laws, and of other dissidents, religious dissenters. And your second question?
When you're talking about under Khrushchev with his intensification of religious persecution against sectarians, was that primarily a communist government initiated movement, or was there influence from like the Orthodox to say, hey, we can put out these sectarian groups and the communist government to do it?
It was very much Nikita Khrushchev's initiative. It was part of the building of communism, was to eradicate religion. But he knew, I think, that he wasn't going to eradicate the Orthodox Church. He was there. And as I said in my paper, it was very much part of the Russian grand narrative. It was so much a part of the history. And I referred to the Second World War. Very interesting how the Stalinist government in the Second World War revived this Holy Russia rhetoric associated with Alexander Nevsky and so on. What is incidentally also surprising is that the Soviet government in the 1940s felt that they have to have the Baptists and others on board as well. Why not just encourage the Orthodox Church to get behind the Soviet war effort? There's a big question, why did Stalin feel that he needed to have the Baptists and others on board as well? But evidently he did. Evidently he felt that the Protestant community in the Soviet Union was sufficiently large to be worth enlisting along with the Orthodox Church. But Khrushchev's campaign, according to the Russian commentator I've quoted, Tatyana Nikolskaya, had this particularly anti-sect character. Now, the picture is a bit more nuanced because the Orthodox Church did come in for some clobbering as well. But it is not at all surprising that there was this particular animus against the sectanti, against the sect members. Well, the Orthodox Church has a certain cachet to it, and you know, you're not going to eradicate. Politics is the art of the possible, so you're not going to eradicate it soon. So don't waste too much effort on trying to eradicate it.
Maybe one last question, or two?
There's one here.
Sir, I would imagine that the flow of information in matched the control given to the flow of information out. So with that in mind, I would suspect that there's not a great deal of new theological material flowing in terms of for the training of pastors, for the education of congregants, you know, during this multi-decade period. But what, the stuff they had, was that even able to be maintained in its accuracy? Was there pressure to even change the scriptures themselves based on the both propaganda and censorship policies of the government? So were right down to the actual translations of the Bible, were they able to maintain accurate translations, or was even were things changed?
Yeah. Translation, well, there was only one Russian version of the Bible, and that was the version, the so-called synodal version, done during the 19th century, very much the work of the Orthodox Church. That was, and still is, the sort of authorized version of most Russian Protestants. And no, there was no pressure, if you like, to change any of that. I've mentioned particularly the official Soviet Baptist publication, The Fraternal Messenger, which appeared from 1945 with that hiatus, 1950 and 52. It's quite funny, actually. You start reading 1953, no explanation at all, no hint, we're glad to be back, you know, nothing. Nothing at all, even in the official history of Baptists in the USSR and the journal. It appeared sometimes four, sometimes five, sometimes six times a year. Again, not always clear why more some years than others. There were also materials produced for teaching purposes, basic books on doctrine, handbooks on church life. Again, very, very carefully.
Were they free of government influence?
Sorry?
How free were they of government influence?
Government influence. Well, they weren't free from government influence in the sense that they had to avoid anything that might be politically sensitive, anything that could be interpreted negatively. As I mentioned, anything on the subject of conversion which suggests in material, for example, that we publish in our countries on conversion, that there might be something wrong with Soviet man or woman. You know, or even that drunkenness may be prolific in Soviet society, which it was. And it was so bad that even the Soviet press wrote about it. But not the Christian press. That wasn't acceptable. So it wasn't free. It was carefully censored and had to keep within fairly strict limits. That's another point that I could make. I've obviously highlighted the articles in the Russian Baptist publication of a religious patriotic nature. Now, these articles represent a small proportion of the material actually produced. And basically, they had to be there. But readers were savvy enough to realize, well, this is there just for the look of the thing, you know, and Soviet people generally didn't take seriously the stuff they read in their own newspapers. So there was an awful lot of stuff published which didn't harp on about the Soviet contributions to the world peace movement, the dangers of nuclear war, the disarmament drive, and the terrible policies of the USA in Korea and Vietnam. There was a lot of stuff published which sort of didn't touch on those things.
One final question.
I wonder if you could speak to the relationship between the Orthodox Church and the Baptists during this period in particular.
Not particularly good. I mean, still today you find this attitude on the part of the Orthodox Church that the Baptists are sectante. I mean, I remember seeing just a few years ago, a leaflet produced by the Orthodox Church in Moscow in connection with extension work being done to the Russian-American Christian University, calling upon local people to take their stand for Holy Russia, and et cetera, et cetera. There's a lot of that. Again, local factors come into play here. In the Ukraine, you might find relationships were a bit better, because in the Ukraine, the Orthodox Church is itself very divided, you know. So you could have some Orthodox who are quite sympathetic towards Baptist and Pentecostals. But the situation in the Ukraine is quite different from the situation in Russia. But no, relationships were not particularly good.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you.